I have not been in Venezuela since last August.
Tom Phillips is The Guardian's Latin America correspondent based in Brazil.
We were granted visas just ahead of the presidential election in July last year. And I was there until about a week after that election, which were some extraordinarily turbulent days. And since then, there has not been another application process. There's a huge queue of journalists, as I understand it, now trying to get to Caracas to get a sense of what's going on the ground. But almost none of us, in fact, I know of only one person who has succeeded.
Yeah, and that's because they themselves are closing their doors to journalists?
For some reason, they don't seem to want foreign journalists there. There are very few foreign journalists based in Caracas. And of course, many of the Venezuelan journalists have themselves left Venezuela over the last few years because of its descent into authoritarian rule. So it's a very difficult media landscape. There are a few people there, but it is not easy at all.
For people who are not steeped in the details, could you, and it's a hard thing to do in one question, but given what you can know from where you are, can you bring us up to date with where we stand now, what the current political situation is inside Venezuela?
Extraordinarily uncertain, which is not entirely unusual. I've been covering Venezuela for the last 7 years, and there are always these moments of extreme tension when one thinks that simultaneously you could be about to be plunged into a new, very different era. And at every one of those moments that I've covered, particularly since 2019, actually things have just stayed the same or gotten even worse from a democratic standpoint. So at the moment we are at perhaps one of the most strange moments, because since August, Donald Trump has been really ramping up the pressure.
Today, the Department of Justice and State Department are announcing a historic $50 million reward for information leading to the arrest of Nicolas Maduro.
Then starting this gigantic military deployment in the Caribbean.
Since September, the U.S. has launched at least 20 strikes on suspected drug boats in the Caribbean Sea, killing more than 80 people.
Something like one-seventh of the U.S. Navy is now in the Caribbean. There is this tsunami of threats and warnings, and, you know, are they going to go in with boots on the ground? Are there going to be airstrikes on Venezuelan soil? We are simultaneously on the cusp of war. And at the same time, we are also on the cusp of a complete normalization of U.S.-Venezuela relations, which might even, you know, who knows, see a Trump International Hotel built in Caracas or something like that. It's very, very odd.
And it all goes to the complete volatility and unpredictability of the Trump administration, which we talk about so often on the podcast. But just to get to the first bit of that, which was the sort of apparent bellicosity and a new aggression coming from Washington directed at Venezuela. I know it's not easy, but put yourself in the shoes of Donald Trump. Just from his point of view, why is it that he regards Venezuela and Maduro in particular as a threat to the United States?
Right. Well, that is the question we are all trying to answer, of course. I mean, I strongly suspect that some of it at least is personal. During Trump's first administration, he tried at the start of 2019 to force Maduro from power, and he completely failed.
Well, many countries, including the United States, called the election a sham and said they would not recognize the results.
And that must have been something of a humiliation for a president who likes to look strong. Another element to it could be what people are referring to as the Monroe Doctrine, right, which is a sort of a repeat of the 200-year-old James Monroe Doctrine for the Western Hemisphere, back then seeking to keep the pesky Europeans out of the region that the US saw as its backyard, and now more geared towards keeping Russia and China out. But of course, the official line is that this is all about two of the issues closest to Donald Trump's heart, migration and drugs, which when you look at those two issues separately, don't stack up. That's why there's such confusion about what the policy actually is. Is it just a sort of vindictive bid to get rid of Maduro second time around, or is there more to it?
Well, let's just go with the first of those two then, migration. He would say that people are indeed fleeing Venezuela. I mean, that is true, and that some of those people are making their way to the US. I mean, he has gone further than just saying that and says that Maduro is emptying his prisons and his insane asylums.
They've dumped hundreds of thousands of people into our country that we didn't want. People from prisons, they emptied their prisons into our country. They also, if you take a look, they emptied their mental institutions and their insane asylums into the United States of America because Joe Biden was the worst president in the history of our country.
I mean, you'll give us a fact check on whether that stacks up. But just in terms of migrants going to the U.S., is there something in there? Has Donald Trump, on that at least, got a point?
there has been and there is still a huge migration crisis involving Venezuela since Maduro came to power in 2013, just after the death of Hugo Chavez. Pretty much since then, there has been this absolutely historic exodus of something like 8 million people from Venezuela. They have ended up in Brazil, many of them in neighboring Colombia, Peru, Chile, where I was reporting on Venezuelan migrants recently, and hundreds of thousands headed north through Central America to the US. So yeah, absolutely, that is true. Of course, the economic collapse of Venezuela predates US sanctions, but those US sanctions certainly compounded the problems in Venezuela. So, you know, the US certainly has a responsibility for that. Have they ended up there? Yes. Have, within that enormous exodus of normal working Venezuelans and Venezuelan families, among them have criminals and members of the Venezuelan gang, Tren de Aragua, that Trump talks so much about, have they moved into other countries? Well, yeah, I was in Chile recently and I saw signs that, you know, the Tren de Aragua does have operations on the Chilean border with Peru. They are causing problems, but that is not the bulk. And I've not seen a shred of evidence that mental institutions, as Trump claimed just a few days ago, have been deliberately emptied into the US. No, the Venezuelans I have met fleeing on foot, often without shoes, into the Brazilian Amazon and to other countries around South America and Latin America are in the almost, you know, their entirety hardworking, desperate people whose lives have been in one way or another destroyed by an absolutely historic economic collapse, the likes of which has not been really seen outside of wartime.
Yeah, no, it is a huge phenomenon across the whole continent. What about the second of these two assertions that you mentioned to us? One issue is migration, the other is drugs.
I think last year we lost close to 300,000 people were killed. That's not mentioning all the families. Have you seen what happens with the families of not only the people killed, the people that are trying to get their son or their daughter off of this poison that they've been fed? I think you're going to find that there's a very receptive ear to doing exactly what they're doing, taking out those boats. And
Donald Trump says that fentanyl is coming into the United States along with cocaine, the former certainly a big part of the opioid crisis, and he blames Venezuela for much of that. Again, act as a fact checker on that claim for us.
My pleasure. No, I mean, fentanyl, of course, a huge, huge problem in the United States, not coming from Venezuela. Venezuela has absolutely no role in the fentanyl market. From what we understand, fentanyl is made using precursor chemicals that come from China, also Southeast Asia now, and moves through Mexico into the US. Venezuela has nothing to do with that, despite Trump's claims that some of these alleged narco boats are stacked up with fentanyl. I mean, it's just, I don't think anyone serious who you speak to believes that that is true. Cocaine, of course, does come from South America. Colombia, Peru, Bolivia are the main producers, but a very small fraction of that is coming through Venezuela. Very little of it is thought to be produced in Venezuela. And I think the bulk of what actually does find its way through Venezuela is ending up in Europe, not the United States. So again, not really true. No.
No, but you brought us to the so-called narco boats, this phrase that is being used by the administration. In fact, what we're often talking about is really rather small. I think people have an image in their mind, perhaps, but actually rather small fishing vessels that have been targeted by the US airstrikes, killing more than 80 people so far. I mean, they have sort of astonished people around the world because they sort of seem to come, as it were, out of nowhere. There'd been no declaration of war, and yet these are acts of war. The UN and other organizations, humanitarian organizations, describe them as extrajudicial executions. You know, if two countries are not at war, you can't just start aiming fire at people. Donald Trump, until recently, had seemed very robust in his sort of defense of that. Something seemed to change this week on that score.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, it started to change with these revelations in the Washington Post that the first of those strikes had included what they call a double tap, a follow-up strike.
The official said that after the first strike, there were people on board who were not killed. The second strike targeted them. The third and fourth strikes were designed to sink the boat.
There was subsequently, allegedly, an order from the Secretary of War to kill everybody.
The commander that was overseeing this operation at the time allegedly ordered the subsequent strike to fulfill the command. According to Caroline Leavitt, the admiral did carry out that second strike, as Caroline Leavitt said, with the authority to do so. She also rejected what the Washington Post was reporting, that Secretary Hegseth said to kill everyone.
So the two, I think, men who were left, by all reports, clinging to the debris of that boat in the sea were then also killed. Now, it's all very murky, but I think that sort of created a whole level of outrage that went beyond the anger and concern that we've seen all around, you know, in the United States and down here in South America.
It's an interesting question why this has seemed very different, and it's partly because there are very long-established rules of the sea that say that even if a ship is an enemy ship, which, again, this hasn't officially been designated that way, then if people are survive and are in the sea clinging for their lives, there's a sort of long-standing rule that they suddenly, in the way like an injured person on a battlefield, you do have to save their life. Yet this allegation is that they went back to make sure and deliberately gave the order to kill them. The other thing that's part of this is a lot of the reporting suggests these are people who are not the drug kingpins that, you know, Trump and Hegseth would have us believe, but instead of quite low-level people, sort of, you know, boat hands, deck hands, stevedores, people who may just have been hired to get the boat on the water rather than people involved in the drugs trade. But just in terms of what the administration itself is saying, the administration's messaging on this has been shifting.
I watched that first strike live. As you can imagine, at the Department of War, we got a lot of things to do. So I didn't stick around for the hour and 2 hours, whatever, where all the sensitive site exploitation digitally occurs. So I moved on to my next meeting. A couple of hours later, I learned that commander had made which he had the complete authority to do, and by the way, Admiral Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat.
There are accusations that they are trying to nominate as a fool guy one admiral, Frank Bradley, as if to suggest that he is the person who, you know, made the call. You know, neither of us are lawyers, but just on its face, does this look to you like a credible case of a war crime committed in the Caribbean?
Well, I think it does to many. And as you say, I mean, one of the most disturbing things is, particularly in the case of that first vessel, there were 11 people reportedly on board it. Now that, according to any expert you talk to, is not the number of people that a drug trafficking boat would be carrying. There would normally be perhaps 3 or 4 people. Who were the others? Were they migrants? Were they completely innocent of any crime? And were they simply killed? And I mean, that, in that sense, absolutely it would be. The double standard and the contrast, and I think the other reason why this week this has become such a big story, is that those killings stand in absolute contrast to the treatment that the Trump administration has just given to the former president of Honduras, Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was sentenced last year to 45 years in jail for being a big fish in the narco world and colluding with Latin American drug traffickers to actually genuinely flood the United States with cocaine and stick it up the gringos' noses, as he reportedly said. And he has just been granted a full pardon and was released by Trump. So it seems like the big traffickers are getting one sort of treatment, and the smaller guys are being sent to an early grave.
Just on that point about the pardon to the Honduras leader, what do you think was in Trump's calculations on that decision?
Goodness, I think people are still grappling with that now. And I've heard some people suggest that somehow Hernandez has managed to tap into this part of Trump's psyche that he was the victim of a witch hunt and a Biden setup. And a few politicians in Latin America from the right have tried that. And maybe it has worked, but we don't really know at the moment, no. But all we know is that on one hand, you have someone who was sentenced by a U.S. court after a major U.S. investigation, part of which happened during Trump's first term, who has suddenly been released right at the start of a four-decade sentence.
Our focus, obviously, on this podcast is about the politics of this, often the U.S. politics of this, and I appreciate you're in Rio, but you will have been struck by the fact that it's not just Democrats who are making noises about these strikes in the Caribbean and the rest of the moves. There are now signs of Republican dissent. Does that, again, lead you and perhaps other commentators and diplomats you're speaking to suspect this might turn into something different? You know, we're so used to Trump doing stuff and just riding it out and moving on to the next thing. But the fact that people on his own side are beginning to grumble, is there a sense that you're picking up in the region that this actually might be a line that has been crossed here?
I'm not sure. I wish I could say that was true. I mean, when we talk about and think about the motivations that Trump has for launching these attacks, I wonder if part of it is not this very draconian, authoritarian wave that is sweeping the Americas at the moment, which means that bodies mean votes. I had the misfortune a couple of weeks ago of covering the biggest police massacre in Brazilian history and going to a favela here in Rio and to see scores and scores and scores of dead people lined up in the streets.
We know this was a massive police raid, police killing at least 114 people. And it's that sheer scale of lethality around these police raids that really have sparked protests in Rio.
And I wondered when I saw those bodies whether that would be politically damaging for Rio's right-wing governor, who, like Trump, calls these traffickers narco-terrorists. And actually, it was very popular. And I wonder if something similar is not going on in the US, that actually these images that are going up on social media, that are going viral of missile strikes on boats, bodies, you know, very popular among, particularly amongst Trump's MAGA base, but others. And they help him sell this idea that the war on drugs is working, when, of course, it does absolutely nothing to solve the underlying issues.
Yes, and they've been claiming, haven't they, that each strike, every time you strike a boat, that saves 25,000 American lives from fentanyl addiction. It's obviously a number plucked from the air, but that is the claim they're making. I mean, it all is very on brand for Pete Hegseth, the man who took office as Secretary of Defense, has renamed himself and his department. So he's now Secretary of War, although even that took a little bit of a jolt when he appeared at a meeting with a name card in front of him where the word secretary was misspelt with a rather unfortunate double S at the beginning, as in SS, secretary. That wouldn't have exactly radiated confidence. But I just want to focus on him a minute, because it has been a bad week for him. A Department of Defense report found that he had violated protocols and policies when he shared secret information on a Signal messaging chat in March that included details of a planned airstrike on Houthi fighters in Yemen. Famously, a reporter, in fact, the editor of The Atlantic magazine, was copied in on that group chat and was privy to all those details. It's a long time ago now, but this, coupled with this report in the Washington Post suggesting Hegseth himself ordered this so-called double tap, it has led to sort of the sense that he picked somebody, to put it generously, flawed as his Secretary of Defense, if not utterly unqualified and wholly inappropriate for that job.
Right. And from a South American perspective, it is absolutely terrifying, frankly, as we ponder what Trump's next move might be, or what the Secretary's next move might be in Venezuela. Are we going to see strikes targeting military installations in Venezuela? Yeah, it is very worrying to think that such a man is in charge of something, someone who obviously knows so little about South America, Venezuela, and the consequences that that kind of strike, let alone a ground invasion, might have.
Well, you've raised the question of what might come next. After the break, Tom and I will discuss how far Donald Trump might go to get Maduro out of office. We'll be right back.